well presented. Last case on the calendar is Nellinger v. Young, 23-1018, and we'll hear from Mr. Paul whenever you're ready, Mr. Paul.
They're not going to be able to see you, Paul. It's a good thing for her to stand up.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Paul.
Why don't you wait just a second for your colleagues?
Oh, sorry.
Let's give you back 2 seconds.
All right. Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Paul on behalf of the appellants. I'm going to strive to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In the case below, the plaintiffs challenged the constitutionality of Colorado's unclaimed property laws. And the district court dismissed the plaintiff for a lack of standing. And I think it's fair to say that both sides' briefs say that this comes down to a question of the standard of review, whether this is a facial challenge to standing or a factual challenge to standing. And we, of course, argued it's a facial, and the defendants argued it's a factual challenge. And I think in preparing for this oral argument, I think the more precise answer is the answer we all learned in law school: it depends. And it depends on whether the obligation to go use the state's unclaimed property administrative claims process is a jurisdictional fact of significance. Because if it's not, then it's a facial challenge. There's no fact that they put in through their declarations that have anything to do with the court's standing.
Can I clear just a little brush with a question that I don't know the answer to despite having read the statutes? Does the owner of the property ever lose the ability to come in and collect the property?
Pursuant to the terms of the statute, no.
Right. Then how is there a taking if my great-grandchildren find out that I didn't cash a check when I worked for the state and it's worth $223? They can come in and get the $223, maybe some interest. What is the taking?
So I'm going to read from a very recent, from earlier this year, a Supreme Court decision relating to unclaimed property laws in Delaware versus Pennsylvania. It actually had to do with which state got to keep the money, because they fought over who got to keep it. And the opening words of Justice Jackson were, "Escheatment is the power of a state as a sovereign to take custody of property deemed abandoned." And if you look at the Nick case that we rely heavily on, it says any disturbance of property, not a permanent taking, a temporary taking, taking custody, taking possession of, disturbing your use of the property is a taking for Fifth Amendment purposes.
It's a taking that I say, thank you very much for taking, because otherwise I would have never known that my great-grandkids wouldn't have gotten $225. In other words, it's the whole thing is set up to be beneficial and is beneficial.
I think that we would dispute only, let me go reset the framing of this case. The plaintiffs in this case fully support the core purpose of the unclaimed property laws, which is to reunite people with their property. The problem is, because they're not following the Constitution in terms of notice, they're not doing that. They didn't give pre-notice, they didn't give post-notice. And our allegation is, and I think the facts more than bear out here, they know who the people are. They could return the property. They don't want to. The district court took judicial notice of the unclaimed property website. Put John Elway in there. He pops up over and over again. Put Congresswoman Boebert in there. Public figures who the state knows who they are, where they are, how to return the property. And they don't, because they don't want to. They're disincentivized.
Because they don't have the email address from the holder. Is that right?
Maybe. The audit shows they didn't even use the information they had.
An enormous administrative burden when you have 1.7 million names in your register, go through and see if you know anybody. In other words, why isn't it fair to put a little bit of onus on that?
I don't dispute that it's a burden and that there's a cost, but they're paid to do it. They keep the interest on over $1 billion. that they hold in their account. Now, we dispute they're actually holding it, but they do actually currently hold more than $1 billion that they haven't spent yet. But they get the interest on all that. That more than pays for whatever effort, administrative burden it is, to give notice. So the issue is, I think really, regardless of the burden, it is, are they obligated under the Constitution to do it? And we haven't even gotten to that point in this case yet, because what the district court held was that the plaintiffs, even though they allege their property was taken, don't have standing to bring this claim because they have to go to the state's administrative claims process and get it back. And of course, once they do, their injury in fact is gone. So they've immunized the Colorado unclaimed property laws from any constitutional challenge. There's no way to do it. And that's exactly what the Nick case held in overturning prior law to say you have a right under 1983 to exercise your Fifth Amendment right and to seek a recovery for that. And when we preclude, when the jurisprudence precluded that with what the Supreme Court termed a catch-22, that it was improper. And they said you always have the right to go directly to federal court. You don't have to go prove up your claim somewhere else and have it extinguished so that you can never go to federal court. And that's the premise of the Nick decision. And I think that's the reason why this has to be a facial challenge, as we've alleged, because it's not a fact of jurisdictional significance to say that they didn't use the claims process. They weren't obligated to use the claims process. They can't be obligated to use the claims process. It would have extinguished their claim. So for that reason, this comes back to, did they allege it's their property? And I think between the Supreme Court's decision in Nick and this court's decision in Rodriguez-Aguirre, where it said colorable allegations of ownership are sufficient. Proof comes later in the case. Colorable allegations are enough, and the plaintiff can't be put to the burden to produce evidence at the pleading stage, evidence that in this case we've made clear only the state possesses, to plead ownership of property. We don't have an evidentiary burden at the pleading stage.
Is that case pre-Iqbal or post-Iqbal? What's the
name? That would be, it's 2001, so yeah. That would be pre-Iqbal.
Doesn't that matter?
I don't think that, I mean, we can add plausibility into this, but that's fine. I mean, the plaintiffs allege that based on the name, the county, and the zip code, it's their property. I think that meets any definition of plausibility. I mean, it's the only information the state provides, but they did cross-check that before making that allegation.
I thought the information in the database differed from the information in their lives, where they live.
No, there's no evidence of that. Actually, that's the evidence that the plaintiffs looked at to cross-check to make this allegation. To be clear, I'll take plaintiff Robert Story, for example. There are a lot of Robert Stories in that database. He's only made this complaint based on one piece of property because those were facts that he could allege. We actually believe the state has more of his property, but they don't provide enough information for us to have made that plausible allegation. So we limited it to one. So I think this is even, I actually don't think, again, Iqbal clearly gives a plausibility requirement, but that's not proof of ownership. And even if it were, that would be a dismissal with leave to replead to say, well, let's plead some more facts on why you believe this is your property. We can live with that. We can satisfy that. But that's not the basis of the district court's holding. The district court's holding was very clearly, you have to go prove up ownership and get it back. And under the Colorado Unclaimed Property Law, that extinguishes your remedy because your only remedy to file a case in state court post the administrative claims process is if they deny your claim. If they grant your claim, you have no claim. And so you never get to challenge the constitutionality of the process that resulted in the taking in the first place.
So please don't give us our money back because we want to sue you.
We want to fix the process so that the money goes back to the property owners who deserve it. It is a look, the allegation is that it is a broken system. Our plaintiffs have an interest in solving the injury that they have suffered. They've had their property taken. They believe more of their property is taken. And if you look at the litigation that occurred in the Ninth Circuit from the Taylor versus Yee and Taylor versus Wesley cases, the Ninth Circuit plainly held, after years of litigation that they presided over, that case going up and down, said it's not unlikely or remote that your property will be taken in the future. It's likely.
Well, can I ask you about that part? Because yes. You are asking not only for your property back, but you're also asking for a prospective injunction requiring notice, relying on Westby. And our circuit has held in Fascio versus Jones that standing to get an injunction requires, quote, a good chance of being likewise injured in the future. And what distinguishes your two plaintiffs from anybody else in the state from saying, yeah, my property could be subject to a cheat in the future. I have no reason to think it will, or, you know, I don't even know of any bank accounts or accounts that would be subject to it. How can we possibly say that you have satisfied the Fascio standard of showing a good chance of being injured in the future for requiring a prospective notice requirement?
So I think I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first would be, it's not as if every citizen of Colorado would have the same standing as these plaintiffs do, because the state currently holds their property. So it is that current injury.
Okay.
And then...
That's retrospective.
It is. It's retrospective. Okay. But again, they've looked at the website. It shows other instances of their names. So there may be more. And I think looking at the Taylor versus Wesley decision from the Ninth Circuit, there's two things. It is, as they've alleged, this website, despite the claim that it's easy to use, it's not at all. And so there is this need to continually monitor and check. So it's your time and effort to keep that from happening or to check to see.
Did you present the need to continue to surveil, to continue to monitor? Did you present that in district court?
We made the argument. We didn't make that as an allegation in the complaint, because I think it flows, at least from our perspective, it flowed from the fact of we are under the threat of future takings.
Okay.
And current takings that we don't yet know about, at least. But I think that's...
Why wouldn't everybody in the state then need to continue to monitor also?
The
problem is still, bold. I'm not trying to argue with you, but isn't the question still whether or not there's... You know, that there's any reason to think that your property is going to be subject in the future. You know, there's lots of possibilities, but why would I continue to monitor in Oklahoma, my website, because my property may be subject to SG? Well, you know, a lot of things may happen.
I'm sorry. I think the answer to that is, as I reflect on what you're saying, the concern I'm hearing, at least, is that standing would be broad. I think that's purely a function that the state currently holds more than 1.6 million pieces of property and over $1 billion for millions of people. It is broad because the taking has been so broad. And so, sure, should it be narrower? If their takings were narrower, it would be narrower. I think the plaintiffs are different in that they do have current property being held by the state, not just the fear of additional property being taken. All right, with that, I'll reserve my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm First Assistant Attorney General Leanne Morrill on behalf of Defendants Appellees, Colorado State Treasurer Dave Young, and Unclaimed Property Division Director Bianca Gardelli. Before diving into the issues raised by this appeal, I'd like to ground our discussion with a brief overview of the Colorado law that defendants administer and plaintiff's class action claims concern, namely the Revised Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, or RUPA for short, and which defendants publicly refer to as the Great Colorado Payback Program. As the public moniker suggests, RUPA is a custodial act under which title to abandoned property never vests in the state of Colorado. Rather, defendants merely hold such property in custody for the benefit of the owner, which could include the owner's heirs, creditors, assigns, and any person claiming to be the owner of such property may file a claim to collect it at any time and at no cost to the claimant. And if such a claim is filed, the defendants must pay or deliver the property to a claimant if they receive evidence sufficient to establish to their satisfaction that the claimant is the owner of the property. Finally, RUPA defines owner broadly as a person that has a legal, beneficial, or equitable interest in abandoned property, and as I mentioned, includes heirs, creditors, depositors, beneficiaries, payees, and others. As a result, whether a person is, in fact, an actual owner of abandoned property is essential and central to fulfilling RUPA's public purpose, which is to safeguard such property until it can be reunited with its rightful owner. And to be clear, plaintiffs here do not challenge this public purpose. Rather, their complaint expressly requested that the trial court enjoin defendants from allowing any known company or financial institution to retain property and funds that are subject to transfer pursuant to the RUPA, as well as the imposition of a constructive trust over an accounting of all monies currently in the trust fund. Turning now to the issue of standing, there are three reasons why this court should affirm that plaintiffs lack standing. First, defendants mounted both a facial and factual attack on plaintiff's standing below. Second, the trial court's dismissal order ruled on both types of attack. And third, this court can affirm the trial court's dismissal for lack of standing based on either or both types of attack because each is supported by the record below. So turning to the first basis for affirming, the record below clearly reflects that defendants mounted both a facial and factual attack on standing.
Where will I find, I'm looking at the motion to dismiss, where would I find that? I see where you talk about the standard for a factual attack and the standard for a facial attack. We often see boilerplate on summary judgment that never comes up later in the motion. So where will I find in the motion to dismiss that you are lodging a factual attack?
Thank you, Your Honor. Beginning at pages A51, Appendix 51, defendants argue that the complaint failed to allege injuries to the plaintiff's protected interests from defendants' allegedly improper seizure, sale, destruction of safe deposit box contents, and security investment vehicles, the failure to pay dividends or interest on seized property, and sale of certain seized property. Specifically, the complaint failed to allege that either or both of the properties identified in the complaint was stored in a safe deposit box, was dividend paying or interest bearing, or was the type of property the defendants had to obtain to sell to obtain a cash value. Again, that's Appendix 51.
So all of that refers, I assume you're going to acknowledge that is the part of the facial attack.
Facial attack, Your Honor.
Right.
Carrying on page Appendix 52, we further allege that, or defendants further argued that plaintiffs failed to allege that certain injuries are fairly traceable to the defendant's conduct, and instead improperly allege that they were caused by third parties not before the court, specifically holders, who plaintiffs claim that RUPA does not afford adequate pre-transfer notice that notice requirement is a direct one imposed by RUPA on holders.
So this is still part of the facial attack?
Still part of the facial attack.
Right. Right.
So A51 and A52. Additionally, carrying on into A52 and 53, facial attack by failing to allege a continuing injury. There's no discussion in the complaint whatsoever about the likelihood of plaintiffs having additional properties that would be turned over to defendants for safekeeping as abandoned property. The complaint is simply silent on any type of alleged continuing injury. Turning now to the factual attack the defendants mounted below, that begins at page appendix A50, which cited and attached the declaration of Director Gardelli. That is at appendix, the declaration is at appendix 77 and 79. The court will note that defendants only cited Director Gardelli's declaration in their in the standing portions of their motion to dismiss.
And that was in the declaration of Director Gardelli was only on the issue of whether or not they submitted an administrative claim, right?
It was on that, Your Honor, as to both properties identified in the complaint, but it was also more than that. For each property identified in the complaint, the declaration of Director Gardelli affirmatively stated that neither type of property, it affirmatively stated that both types of property are cash, meaning that they are not tangible property.
And where will I find these references in the motion to dismiss?
Yes, again, this is at appendix 50, citing and attaching the declaration of Director Gardelli.
And that was only with regard to the administrative claim. No administrative claims have been submitted to date for the properties identified in the complaint. I never saw anything else in your motion to dismiss about the content of Director Gardelli's declaration.
Your Honor, we did argue and cite to her declaration about the type of property that the two properties identified in the complaint are.
Okay, so and she says it's cash. Okay,
right.
So we credit that. They say it's their cash. What is the factual challenge to the allegations in the complaint? It doesn't matter if it's cash or a table. It doesn't matter if they submitted an administrative claim because they don't claim that they submitted an administrative claim. They argue legally that it's unnecessary.
A couple answers to that question. First of all, it does matter what type of the property is because plaintiffs are again, two individuals trying to maintain a class action on behalf of 1.7 million people, including initially in the complaint, a Fourth Amendment right to privacy claim tied directly to the contents of safe deposit boxes. That is tangible property. Cash, in contrast, is intangible property. Plaintiffs the properties identified in the complaint are not the contents of safety deposit box. Similarly, plaintiffs are trying to maintain claims on their own behalf and on behalf of countless others that...
this might be our good arguments that they shouldn't be able to certify the class, but I don't understand how that pertains to whether or not they incurred an injury in fact.
Well, it's incumbent upon them as class representatives to assert their injuries to their own interests.
Right.
If the properties identified in the complaint that they're alleging they own are cash and are not interest bearing, are not dividend paying, are not safety deposit box contents, then they are not the type of properties that would support the injuries needed to assert the Fourth Amendment and Contracts Clause claims, which they voluntarily dismissed in their reply to the defendant's motion to dismiss. So Director Gardelli's declaration had a direct impact on plaintiffs dropping some of their claims because they recognize that they lack standing to maintain them either on their own behalf, much less on behalf of countless others. So again, also mounted a factual attack as indicated. Those citations in the record are at A51. We cited and discussed the standard of review for both a facial and factual attack at A47. Our reply in support of the motion to dismiss stated that defendants mounted a factual attack on standing here. That's A162. And we also included a second declaration of Director Gardelli attached to the reply in support of the motion to dismiss, because one of plaintiff's claims here is, well, you know, even if the notice that we allege was not given before the property was transferred to defendant's custody was required to be given by holders, right? So it's not directly traceable to defendant's failure to provide pre-transfer notice. They say, oh, in their response to the motion to dismiss, they argue for the first time, oh, well, it's reasonably inferable that the defendant's confidential records about the administration of RUPA contain the email addresses for each plaintiff. So in the reply in support of the motion to dismiss, again, only in the standing section of the reply, defendants attached a second declaration of Director Gardelli, and that established, in fact, no, defendants do not have any email address associated with either properties in the complaint.
Do the plaintiffs not have standing because automatically if they don't file an administrative claim?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Is that what the district court said? It looks to me like the district court said no standing, your claims of injuries are conjectural because plaintiffs failed to allege that they have filed any administrative claim to establish ownership.
That is correct. That is the bulk of the analysis of the district court's order.
Is it mistaken, though? In other words, can a plaintiff sue without having filed an administrative claim?
They can if they do more than allege purely conclusory allegations of ownership, right? So a facial attack is a facially valid complaint that sets forth standing is one where a court considers the allegations of fact in the complaint without regard to mere conclusory allegations of jurisdiction. That's the Groundhog v. Keeler case.
What about Iqbal? Why is everybody afraid of Iqbal? Nobody's citing Iqbal.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of Iqbal, Your Honor. I think Iqbal is defendant's friend. They have to be plausible. And that goes exactly to one of the questions that you asked, counsel for the appellants, which is, wasn't there a mismatch in the zip code provided by one of the defendants? And in fact, there was a mismatch, right? So defendant Nellinger alleges in the complaint that he's a longtime resident of Canyon City, Colorado, which is in Fremont County. But then the parcel or the piece of property that he identifies in screenshots from defendant's website does not list either Canyon City as the city, it lists Colorado Springs, and it also does not list the zip code for Canyon City. That zip code this court can take judicial notice of is 81212. The zip code listed in the complaint for the property that defendant Nellinger claims is his without anything more is 80906.
So is it implausibly alleged?
Correct. Yes. Yes. And we would submit that that is insufficient under the facial standards, right? So our defendant's position is we can win on our facial attack, we can win on our factual attack, we can win on both. And as a general rule, we at the state try to avoid giving plaintiffs a roadmap for how to facially allege standing. But we will provide one to this court if it helps you look at the record that's before you and find out why they failed to get it done in their complaint. So Nellinger could have easily alleged that he had an account at Verizon Wireless at some point in time. The dates of the account, he may have even been able to provide an account number. He certainly could have provided the address at which he believed that Verizon account, the complete residential address at which he believed that account was maintained. Same for plaintiff Story, who his counsel admits to this court in argument, there are lots of Robert Stories out there. It's a common name. Any one of them could be the plaintiff or not the plaintiff, which might be the reason why he didn't receive notice, because he is not, in fact, the owner of the property. That is why actual ownership of property is key to plaintiffs being able to maintain their standing. I see my time is up. Unless there are further questions, I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think I want to hit four points from what I heard. I think the first is responding, Judge Phillips, to your concern, what I view as really more of a framing issue. But I want to make clear that the plaintiffs in this case are not trying to dismantle the unclaimed property laws. In fact, the irony of the moniker they've given it as the Great Colorado Payback, they want that to be true. It's just not. They want them to give money back, and they'd like their own money back. This isn't an attack on the unclaimed property laws in any way, shape, or form. It's an effort to improve it and to make it live up to its core mission. The second point is the Iqbal point, which is maybe two points. I did look back, and this was one of the cases that we relied on in our brief, the Graff decision from this court, again from earlier this year, that reiterated the Rodriguez-Aguirre point, which is at the motion-to-dismiss stage, a defendant cannot impose upon a plaintiff the obligation of adducing evidentiary support for the existence of federal court subject matter jurisdiction by simply challenging in summary fashion the factual basis for the existence of such jurisdiction. To be clear on this point, in the context of this case, clearly the defendants have information in their possession to determine whether the plaintiffs are or are not the owners of this property. And they did not put the evidence in that they're not, which they could have done.
Are you talking about something beyond their email?
I'm basing that on whatever it is that they would use to make the determination under the claims process, because that's solely within their discretion.
Is whatever makes that so alleged in the complaint? Here's why they know that it's us. And then something given, an email address?
What's alleged is that the plaintiffs determined it was their property based on the name, the city, and the zip code. I think that's enough, but again, if this were just an Iqbal issue, that would be an easy fix, and we'd be still at the district court fixing that issue. But that's not the district court's holding. With respect, I see my time is up.
You can keep answering these questions. So.
It's really not asking that much, is it, to require an allegation? Here's what the property is we found under this name, and here's my connection to it. Turns out that I did have a Verizon account, or it turns out that I was involved with the legal title company that then sent the check as the holder. If you say that, sounds like you're golden, but if you don't say that, raises the question, why didn't you?
Well, I think that's the standard we'd be happy with if we could get there. That's not what we lost on. If we would have, we just would have refiled and made those allegations. Those are allegations we can make. But
the court said conjectural and that you hadn't tied yourself to the property enough.
I think, with respect, Your Honor, I think the district court's order makes clear, and the defendants to this court argued that was the basis of the district court's order, was that we had not and could not allege ownership without going and submitting a claim to the administrative claims process. If that's not the standard, it's a standard we can live with.
It says two things. It says that one place, and the next page it says it's conjectural, but basically because you didn't tie yourself to it. But I take your point.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. This matter is submitted, well presented on both sides. Court is in recess until 8:30 tomorrow morning.